following is a teleconference entitled Crisis and Opportunity, Social Change Scenario Planning for 2020, and was convened by the Science and Environmental Health Network and the SmartBeam Strategy and Training Project to discuss the precautionary principle.
I'm Carolyn Raffensperger, and I wanted to welcome you to this call. I work for the Science and Environmental Health Network. I just wanted to also provide a little background for the call and tell you that in 2005, many of us were ready to articulate a larger vision for this idea called the precautionary principle that many of us had been working on. And at SUN, we had been in dialogue with SmartBeam for a number of years. I think it might have even been 4 years. I don't even remember when. We held a conference in Chicago on nanotechnology, and we invited this strange and wonderful guy named James John Bell to participate in that conference in Chicago. So we have been in partnership with SmartBeam for quite a while. So in 2005, when we were thinking about how to carry the precautionary principle out and more widely into the world, SmartBeam were the most likely suspects for us to contact. So in 2005, our charge to SmartBeam was based on the theory that we knew enough about the dynamic characters and plot line around the precautionary principle to say, if we can imagine the future we want, we can also step back and construct the storylines that move us in that direction. So the documents that you have in front of you were the result of this collaboration. And, you know, it's almost a year after the national conference on the precautionary principle, and we thought that this would be a great time to think long-term about the story and the vision. So we invited you, and you are some of the best minds and hearts out there, and we wanted to further the collaboration in this experiment. So SmartBeam is going to speak for about 25 minutes, and then we'll open the floor for discussion, and at that point you can unmute your phone. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Patrick Rainsborough from SmartBeam.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you to everyone who's on the call. We're really honored by the range of folks and the number of attendees who have come out to participate in this conversation. So we've got folks from different issue areas and movements. We've got veterans of precautionary principle work, and we've got some folks that are new to the precautionary principle. So we hope that regardless of how much you use the precautionary principle in your work, that this call is going to really spark conversations that are relevant for everyone, because we're all going to the future, so we all got to think about it. So just to give you an overview, I want to tell you a little bit about this project and the sort of scenario planning and the work about how do you apply scenario development work specifically to social change efforts. And then we want to just highlight a couple of the few key trends. For any of you that actually read the entirety of these documents, you get a special gold star, since we know they are quite lengthy documents. But we really just want to highlight a couple of the key trends and then have a broader conversation with you all about what are the key trends that you're seeing in your work, and what are the things that are most important to you about the future. So SmartBeam came to this work from our perspective of a group that was founded to create a stronger culture of strategy in grassroots movements. We were founded because we believe this is a unique historic period where some of the big trends in the world are coming to a head. The ecological crisis, the corporate power. So some of these big trends coming to a head around the ecological crisis and corporate power and some of the historic trends in social justice in this country. We felt there was a need for more long-term thinking to help people move beyond the single-issue boxes and to really combine movement building with strategies that change the stories that shape our culture. And that's what a lot of our work has been based in, is a narrative analysis of power. How is power tied up in the stories that we tell? How do we build movements through the stories that we share? How do we challenge some of the stories that are preventing social change in our work? And how do we create story-based strategies that put storytelling at the center of our work? That stories really define both the possibilities and the limits of the change that we can make in the world. So one of the tools we use to think about changing stories and thinking about the future is the concept of a meme as a unit of the culture, a self-replicating unit that has a life of its own, whether it's an idea or a symbol or a slogan or an image, all these little pieces of the culture that, that continue to replicate. And that's what led to our partnership with Sen, that Sen has been doing so much work around the precautionary principle, and the precautionary principle is a great example of a meme and a meme campaign, a meme as a viral story or a capsule for a story that can spread and create a viral organizing structure for people to do movement building with. So apply the precautionary principle in different ways in different communities. And people are applying the precautionary principle in an incredible range of ways, from doing local policy work to naming or efforts to name a whole worldview shift. So this project around scenario work came about because although SmartMeme were outsiders to the environmental health movement, we wanted to really support the long-term strategy work that was happening around the precautionary principle work that Sen and other groups were doing. So just a note about these documents that that you received. Scenario work in general is not about predicting the future. The future is obviously uncertain and unknown, but scenario work is a great tool for imagining the future, for combining key trend analysis with a creative assessment of possibility. So the type of scenario work that we were doing here that we think is the most relevant to social change efforts is called normative scenario development, or backcasting. And this means rather than trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future and react to it, that instead you're creating the future that we want to see and imagining strategies for how to get there. So the two documents that you received, the mapping the future document, this is the 10 different scenarios. They're all what you could call victory scenarios, where success is achieved. And so you can think of them as different maps for the future we want to create. While the other document, the future of foresight, is a strategy document. It attempts to show some of the building blocks, the different trends that we analyze in order to create those strategies. And those are trends that came out of a lot of analysis and research we did around the existing scenario work. So we pulled resources from everyone from the CIA's National Information Council to nonprofit and corporate futurist groups like the Institute for the Future and the Arlington Institute. And it was an effort to bring these all together and think about what are some of the key trends that are most relevant for the work here. So we're going to structure it in terms of the six drivers as a taxonomy of the future, these six macro categories of thinking about change and trends. These six drivers are demographics, environmental change, economics, science and technology, national and international governance, and kind of a catch-all cultural category of perceptions, beliefs, values, and attitudes. So we want to just highlight some key trends at the intersections of these drivers, and then open it up to conversation about what are the maps you're using in the future and what are your key trends. So to kick it off, I'm going to hand it over to Doyle to talk about the demographics and environmental change drivers.
Thank you, Patrick. So it's a pleasure to be with you all today. My name is Doyle Canning, and I'm with SmartMeme. And the first of three key intersections that we're going to look at is the collision of the generational shifts that are happening in our country with the spike in visibility and urgency of the ecological crisis. We detail some of this story in the ninth scenario called generational gestations. And this was one of our key findings, was in the demographic area. And we want to make a little disclaimer that a lot of the discourse on generations and demographics is driven by marketing and is driven by data that we feel doesn't necessarily, we're critical. We're critical of some of it. Obviously, there are fractures and complexities within generations that around race, class, ethnicity, immigration status, orientation, all that kind of stuff. However, we feel that there are two key shifts that are happening that are significant for social change practitioners to be looking at. The first one is the aging of the baby boom generation, which you've probably seen the advertising and the marketing on this recently. It's really a boon for investment houses and anyone who caters to retirees is trying to cash in on the big baby boom retirement. And the meme that's floating around is redefining retirement. So there's a lot of projections about what will the baby boomers do now that they're empty nesters. Are they going to start new businesses? Are they going to move to Arizona? What are they going to do? And this is a big shift happening. The polling data from Merrill Lynch of their potential baby boomer clientele is that they are very concerned for others. This is a key value that they hold. And their primary concern is actually healthcare. And they're very concerned about the rising cost of healthcare and what their future may be in regards to that. So while the baby boom generation is getting older, there's the eco-boom generation, which is on the move, which are the 80 million people who were born between 82 and 95. Depending on who you ask, that's roughly what's called Generation Y, or also called the millennials. Now, the millennials came of age in a time of awareness of the environment. So they have hopefully, possibly, predictably more sensitivity to environmental issues. They also came of age in the time of 9/11 and the war on terror and the war in Iraq. They're the most branded generation in human history, and due in large part to their overexposure to commercialism and mega brands and emotional branding and lifestyle brands and all that, they are very media savvy, and they are really the engine that's moving the media scape with social networks and online communities like MySpace and YouTube and stuff like that. And this trend is called the screenagers. They are not so much passive consumers of broadcast media as they are producers of digital media. And the aesthetic is really one of remixing, of reappropriating, of changing the story, which we think is pretty exciting. So there's the boomers redefining retirement and the millennials producing digital content and very technologically savvy and media literate. In the midst of this shift, there's a spike of visibility and urgency of the ecological crisis. And we see this particularly with global warming. And Al Gore is testifying today in Congress about the need for action on this issue. And so while global warming is moving more and more into the mainstream and will continue to become important and shape the conversation about the environment, we feel like the precautionary principle in particular can help frame that conversation, because we have to act to prevent further harm, and we also have to act in the face of uncertainty to address global climate change. And a lot of that uncertainty is manufactured, but there's definitely a lot of uncertainty about it. So the precautionary principle can really help us. Another trend, which I just want to mention quickly, is what the Institute for the Future coined as the sick herd, the rising visibility of environmental illness. And particularly for many of you on this call, this is your field, the intersection of public health and the environment. And this is going to continue to be a key issue in our country and in our culture. And as Generation X and Y is finding rising rates of infertility as they want to start families, and also caring for their parents, the boomer generation, who are entering into a healthcare system that is maxed out already. So the precautionary principle, again, is a key piece of that conversation. So some questions at the intersection of demographic and environmental drivers that we see is, how can organizers cultivate intergenerational solidarities and alliances? Another one is how to harvest the energy and potential of the boomer generation. There's a conversation in philanthropy about massive intergenerational wealth transfer that's happening in this shift, but it's not just wealth, it's also the time and the concern that these folks have for future generations, and they'll have hopefully more and more time on their hands to get involved. And obviously, how do we organize with and in solidarity with youth and the millennial generation, and how is the precautionary principle relevant to to their lives and their concerns. So I'm going to hand it over to James.
Thanks, Doyle. I wanted to build on what Doyle was saying with the two drivers she focused on, and specifically focus in on the critical nexus between a couple of the drivers that we discussed in the Future of Foresight document, the science and tech driver, and the cultural catch-all driver, perception, attitudes, and belief. The specific critical nexus that I wanted to point out is to be called the rapid technology advances spawn crowd power. And so to unpack this, what we have going on here is that exponential tech growth and convergences are proliferating in different ways among various subcultures and industry sectors. And so the technological and cultural differences between these subcultures, what sometimes is called like a generation gap, actually represents an event horizon. An older example of a technological event horizon would be at one time a single observer could inventory the entire internet. This is like way back in the heyday of the internet. Then early on in the internet's development, an event horizon was reached, and an observer couldn't complete the inventory before new developments came online. So this same phenomenon, this event horizon, has occurred with regard to technological development itself. And so whereas once you could inventory technological development in a society, now among various sectors, especially biotechnology and nanotechnology, these event horizons are being achieved. So in consumer technology, this increased growth in tech development is fueling a rapid adoption of many different new technologies, specifically like handheld and portable devices. And as these devices get more affordable and smaller and embedded into clothing and sunglasses and other items, this is enabling what we wrote about in the scenario work as a personalization and a specialization of mass culture. And so if you want to like remember back to how quickly the cell phone was adopted by society in our lifetimes, now we have like the iPhone coming out this summer, slated for the same type of massive adoption, as we pointed out in the scenario work, in a couple of the different scenarios, is this adoption of radio frequency ID tags, RFID, that's going to get rolled out over the next 5 to 10 years. And right now, RFID is used at the warehouse and trucking level to track pallet level, the pallets of products. But as we point out in the scenarios, it's going to provide consumers with access to info when it's embedded in the products themselves. So somebody could scan with their iPhone contraption an item in a store and get all of the data that could either be provided by the product's manufacturer or by activist organizations as to the toxicology that's associated with that product, or where it was made, like in a sweatshop over in Asia. So that RFID technology is on the way, probably within the next 5 to 10 years. So these types of accelerated tech trends are the engines behind massive cultural shifts. And so some of these shifts are being called crowd power is one that we wanted to focus on. And so this builds on what Doyle was saying about how the millennials network and repurpose media. Examples of crowd power right now are sites like YouTube, the video server site, and MySpace. And so the key thing to remember about crowd power is that creativity beats money in the mass media. And so no longer is your ability to get national attention solely based on the amount of money you have, but that literally creativity can launch a new meme into the culture. And so some of you might have seen very recently. An example of this would be the Barack Obama YouTube attack ad against Hillary Clinton, which was made by unknown producers, put up on YouTube, and achieved national attention and notoriety very quickly. Another example of these accelerated tech trends is crowdsourcing. And so crowdsourcing is where, through a massive networked society, you can allow for large numbers of people to collaborate on a project and actually source labor from the crowd and the users themselves of a specific technology. And so an example, some examples of that going on right now would be Wikipedia or eBay or Kiva.org, the micro-lending site. So to wrap up, we feel this shift in the way society is assessing these new technologies, accessing these new technologies, and the shift in the means of tech production itself, this massive tech convergence that I talked about, these event horizons, will require a larger movement-building conversation about how to critique and assess technology, where the precautionary principle will play a key role. And SmartMeme, ourselves, we've been following and helping to drive this conversation specifically around nanotech development with a number of different groups, as Carolyn mentioned on the beginning of the call, for a number of years now. So to summarize, thus, while new tech advances and cultural shifts offer advantages for us to access trends like crowd power and crowdsourcing, this technology convergence itself poses a number of potential dangers for which the precautionary principle is apt to address. I'm going to hand it over to Patrick to wrap up the final two drivers.
Well, in the final two drivers, the international governance and economics, like all the other drivers, these are huge sweeping areas. But just selecting one of the key trends from within it that we used in creating these scenario maps within governance was U.S. unilateralism. You know, that we're living in a situation of the U.S. as a global military superpower that has been on an overtly imperial trajectory, particularly with the Bush administration. The U.S. government has been operating outside of international law, has been avoiding multilateral frameworks. And regardless of administration changes or what happens in Iraq, the U.S. is going to continue to have a global military empire, military installations in over 150 different countries. And this military infrastructure is, of course, very linked to the process of corporate globalization and the role of U.S.-based corporations directing resources to the United States. So this raises a significant macro issue for all social movements inside the United States, that we're organizing and acting in what's truly the engine room of the global economy. And what does that mean in terms of global solidarity actions and people's globalization and connections between social movements in the U.S. and social movements outside the U.S.? Now, at one of the key centers of gravity of this intersection between U.S. corporate power and U.S. military power is of course, oil as a key determinant of U.S. foreign policy. Most blatantly exemplified right now by what's happening with the Iraqi oil law, as we see a massive privatization of Iraq's oil resources and a huge resource grab by U.S. and multinational oil companies of what was previously a state resource inside Iraq. Now, this is not new, but the increased visibility of it inside the U.S. is. And that's driving one of the other trends that we think is very interesting and has a lot of potential over the coming decade, which is the new local. As people increasingly in their communities see the inability of particularly the federal government to address some of these sweeping issues of our time, whether it's global warming or oil wars or the growing peak oil meme as more people become aware of the possibility that we'll run out of oil within the next generation, and there'll be disruptions around that, that people are turning to drive action and initiative at the local level. So this is expressing itself in lots of different ways. Some of the ways we talk about this trend in the document include the sort of seemingly contradictory but overlapping trends of places less important, places more important, looking at place being less important as an increased sector of the economy that has the ability to work from wherever, to be telecommuters, and to choose the locations that they want to work in, as well as that meaning that place is more important, that for that sector of the population, that they're not getting social needs met in the workplace, they're turning to be more invested in the community. There's a growing awareness of the tension between the local and the global economy. You can just look at the interesting things that may happen now that, that Walmart has announced it's going to be selling organic food, but much of it's going to be sourced from China, so that you have a real people looking at local as a way to go beyond organic. So in terms of a big question for social movements is, how do we harness this energy, regardless of what happens at the federal and state levels? Hopefully things will begin to really move there, but that there's a real energy to be harnessed around the new localism, and particularly in terms of building alliances between more resourced and privileged communities that have access to resources and the communities that are being left behind. If we look at some of the current questions around supporting Gulf Coast communities, how do we engage in long-term support and community building with increasing numbers of communities that are being devastated by global warming and future eco-spasms, particularly when, as Doyle pointed out, that increasingly those communities are going to be poor communities and communities of color. So to conclude us, I want to hand it back over to Doyle and then wrap it up.
Thanks, Patrick. So we wanted to leave you with some of the big questions that we had coming out of this process, which if you want to look at them in detail, they're in Section 13 of the Future of Foresight. It's called Macro Strategy and Messaging Issues. But the ones we want to look at today are specifically about critical questions about the precautionary principle's relationship with other movements. But we feel that this relates to the field of social change as a whole, because these movements will be some of the key engines of civil society in the next 15 years, given the survey that we've done of these trends. The first is climate justice. There is an emerging movement addressing climate change with an understanding of its disproportionate impact on poor people and people of color globally, as well as within the United States. And this movement is going to continue to grow and should be supported and funded and strong and able to address the crisis that is posed by global warming and led by people who are most directly affected by this issue. The second, as Patrick was just talking about, being inside the engine room of the global economy, is the global anti-war, anti-militarism movement. And this is the broadest progressive issue in our country right now. And the war, as we think about and work with young people a lot through our story program, the war is one of their primary concerns. And it is in large part being fought by Generation Y and poor people and young people of color. And it impacts these constituencies directly, but it also impacts the psyche of the entire generation, and that's going to be lasting. And the trajectory of the United States foreign policy is not, as Patrick was discussing, is not going to change anytime soon. So how does a social movement within the U.S. work to address U.S. superpower politics and dismantle the military-industrial complex? And how do we work in solidarity with the rest of the world, who is pretty fed up with the way the U.S. operates unilaterally? The third is environmental justice. And in looking at the intersection of all these trends, unfortunately, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. And this means that more and more poor communities and communities of color are going to bear the brunt of ecological crisis. And so whether we're talking about dumping nuclear waste on Indian lands or removing mountaintops in Appalachia, or the melting ice caps flooding out low-lying areas across the world, or we're talking about fighting big chemical companies in Cancer Alley or other fence-line communities, all of these fights are going to intensify. And how does the precautionary principle amplify and support environmental justice is a key question. And how are the principles of environmental justice incorporated into all of our work at multiple levels? Because environmental justice really is the intersection of social justice and ecological sanity. So these are some of the challenges that we're facing, and they call for sophisticated thinking and thoughtful action, and also call for courage. And we really want to leave you with trying to answer the question, how do the scenarios and this work affect me, or why am I on this call? We hope that this project offers you some analysis and some inspiration that's provocative and useful for you and can be helpful in your own efforts to think about the future of social change. We were asked by SEND to envision fundamental transformation in the political system, economy, and culture using the precautionary principle. And that was a long and daunting and exhilarating project and really embodied one of our tenets of our curriculum at SmartMeme, which is that people will only go somewhere they have first been in their minds. So our task is to continue to envision a movement inside the United States that is holistic, that has the capacity to act at the intersections of all these trends, a movement that's accountable, that's multiracial, that's cross-class, and daring and courageous. And as people inside the U.S., we need to be bold. We need to have vision. And we hope that this project will help inspire more conversation about how to do that together.